Mr. Arthur Eel, seven. We're talking about your time having joined HMS Newfoundland that was being rebuilt or refitted in Boston. We're talking about your relations with the officers, and you were saying about how they dressed for dinner and things. If you'd like.
Well, dinner sounds a little bit pompous. We didn't often dine. Dinner would be when you were entertaining the captain, or when you would have a particular part of a particular purpose. And then you would dress for dinner, which meant nothing more than your best uniform with a stick-out white collar and a bow tie, which didn't really cost very much. In the tropics, it was a little different, if I can go ahead a bit. In the tropics, dressing for dinner would be a white bum freezer, that was a little white uniform jacket, with shoulder boards, with your rank, and again, stick-up collar, white tie, a black tie, and a black cummerbund, your blue uniform trousers. So that was, again, it added a little formality. And if you had dinner, and when we dined, we did in style. The anteroom, after all, was next to the wardroom, which is where you had your drinks, and in the anteroom would be the Royal Marine band. We'd have a string quartet playing light music and entertaining us. We would buy the bandmaster a glass of port, which is traditional, and go into dinner. And dinner, of course, there'd be the port we'd be going round, starting with the mess president, except that it didn't. It finished with the mess president. He would pass it on, and he'd be the last one to help. That was after dinner. Before dinner, there would be grace, would be said, and the naval grace, which was generally used if there wasn't a if the party wasn't giving it, was the mess president going, "Thank God." And that was the grace, which I think is a very suitable one. Occasional, there's a joke, the mess president would look around and say, "Is the padre present?" To see if he'd say that. And somebody would say, "No, padre's ashore." And the mess president would then say, "Thank God." Well, I'm sure that's a fairly common joke. But dinner was really three or four courses, and you'd finish up with angels on horseback or whatever it is, oysters and a bit of, or usually prunes with a little bacon around it and on a stick. And we had quite a style. And then after playing these silly games like Cardinal Puff, which I still remember losing, when you lost, you bought another round of drinks. We made it even harder to remember the routine. But that be that as it may. So, in the wardroom,
What were the drinking habits like?
They were much more controlled. I was rationed to 10 shillings a week. And you'd not.
Who by? By yourself or by?
No, that was the regulations in the wardroom. Junior officers, mess bill must not exceed 10 shillings a week. And you'd sign a chit for a drink. And of course, I developed the habit, as I still have it, of drinking Coates Plymouth gin, pink, and no water. The water was scarce on board. And we would play liar dice, which is poker dice. That was a standard game which you could have as many people as you like joining in, which was fun. Again, there was less formality. Remember that the captain would always be in his own quarters. He would only come into the wardroom by invitation. But you'd have the commander and the engineer commander, paymaster commander, sergeant commander, all those SOBs, senior old boys or senior old buggers or whatever. But they would be not totally standoffish. They would be amongst themselves, and the young ones would be. You had the Royal Marine captain there and the subaltern, and the Royal Marine captain is always called Major on board because he ranks as a Major when he's afloat and a captain when he's ashore, so he's always called Major. And he was very smart indeed. And he would be the one who supplied me with my own servant. I had a Marine servant who looked after me.
Is this the first servant you'd had?
Oh, yes.
And what did the servant do for you? What was his job?
His job was to make sure that I wasn't bothered with domestic housekeeping details. He'd come into my cabin, make up the bunk, get my laundry sorted out, all those little things, empty the waste basket. It's not an enormous amount of work to do, but he'd make sure that the uniform was there, and when we were going into tropical things, he would make sure that I had my white cap covers out or my white uniform. It was to take care of the small domestic details and let me get on with my real job. That was the theory. And I think he enjoyed it. They got an allowance, and I don't think he got much from me because I didn't have much to give. But no, that was the way it went. And it was a much more formal, and it was the sort of Navy I'd wanted to be in. It was the real Navy.
Now, when did you leave Boston?
One of the jobs that we were told we had to do in Boston, which was an important one, was that we had to act, as it were, as ambassadors. And the social side ashore was considered to be important for the war effort. And I think it's true that we are in good relations with the people ashore. I think probably did have some effect. After all, I was mixing up at really rather high level with Mrs. Adams, and I remember going out and having lunch with Senator Lowell, I think. And in Boston, they have a saying that they have a toast. Here's to Massachusetts, the land of the bean and the cod, where the Cabots speak unto Lowells and the Lowells speak unto God. Well, I wasn't God, but he was talking to me, so it was all right. And but it did make a difference if they thought that we deserved to be helped. And I was invited out quite often, and I was encouraged to accept these invitations to lunch in Boston itself. And the biggest problem with lunching was the amount of drink that was poured in. They were much heavier drinkers than we were. Two or three double whiskies before lunch would be the thing. Whiskey, sour, old-fashioned, all the rest of it. We weren't used to it. I did my best. And I remember one lunch occasion, I was told we'd like you to meet a young American naval officer who just came back from the Pacific. And I met him two or three times after that. I didn't like him very much. His name was J.F. Kennedy. And he was pumping me like mad to find out what was going on in the old country, as it were. Because the Kennedys were not really British friends, were they? But that, I think, was a fairly important job that we did for the war effort to try to keep the Americans on our side. But from Boston, we went down to Norfolk, Virginia.
And when would that be about?
The spring. And from there we picked up about 25 schoolboys who'd been evacuated from Britain, and we were taking them home. And we didn't have any midshipmen on board, so they were messed in the gun room. The gun room is still use the same language they had in Nelson's time. It's where the young gentlemen, the midshipmen's mess, and they have the president of their mess is a sub-lieutenant. And they're quite separate from the wardroom. We didn't have any midshipmen then, so we put the boys in there. I think they enjoyed it. So we took them. Our first stop after Norfolk was St. John's, Newfoundland. Now, HMS Newfoundland, going into Newfoundland, was quite an event for the locals in St. John's. And for 3 days, the whole town and the ship was one continuous party. I don't think we got much sleep. I don't think many of us have stayed sober for too long. And if you're in uniform, you could go ashore and any car would stop and say, where do you want to go? And they'd take you and show you around. They couldn't have been friendlier. They're nice people. And of course, it's a very in those days, it was a very poor country. It was obviously poor. It was wooden houses, and standard of living was low. And when we finally left St. John's, I was off to watch Leaving Harbour, and the navigator officer was taking it out, and the captain comes on the bridge wearing sunglasses. Well, it was a bit overcast, and we were worried about icebergs outside, had been reported. And I remember hearing the navigator, that was Lieutenant Commander Clutterbuck. He became a vice admiral in the end. But David Clutterbuck says to the captain, sir, forgive me, why are you wearing your sunglasses? It's not, you know, the sun isn't all that bright, is it? And the captain said, well, it's not to protect my eyes against the sun, it's against other people. So we finally left and came back to the Clyde, where there was a major refit. Because you can only get some things done in America, and the other things have to be done in on the Clyde. And from there...
What sort of thing are we talking about?
Armament, radar, all the... There was a certain amount of secrecy, I suspect, still. The stuff that you didn't want the Americans to necessarily to get their hands on. It's a funny thing. Although they were allies, there were certain differences. But anyway... So, from there, we go up to Scarpa Flow. At Christmas, I remember that would be around November.
So after the end of the war?
No. This was the war.
Sorry, yes. Sorry.
Before this was just before D-Day. When was D-Day? I don't remember.
June 44.
44. So this would be. In the spring of 44. Sorry, I've got it wrong. I know in the autumn of 44 we were in Jib, so this will be in the autumn of 44. We'd be up after D-Day. We'd be up in the Shetlands, again working up. And the Shetlands... Not the Shetland, Scarpa Flow is an appalling place. The famous story about the sailor hauled up in front of his commander for having unlawful intercourse with a sheep. And his excuse was he thought it was a wren in a duffel coat, but they can cut that out if you want to. I do leave it in.
And what happens exactly? What were you doing at Scapa? Just working up?
Getting cold and wet, working up. There's always a routine on board, correcting. My job was helping the navigating officer. I was his tanky. I was chart correcting, that sort of thing. There's always chart correcting to go on. Wrecks, mines, all this sort of thing. Always there's a load of routine. Housekeeping work, if you like. But in the end, we leave Scarpa and we stop at Jib for Christmas. We spent Christmas in Jib and we had the usual... we were rationed to the number of wrens we could have. There were a very few wrens and a lot more ships. So they all allowed themselves an hour each on a ship and then went on to the next one. It was quite a good party. We left on Boxing Day and went out to Alex. And I remember seeing my first water spout going through the med, and we were closed up for action station because apparently there was still quite a lot of enemy activity about, but we didn't see any of it. And we get to Alex.
That'll be January 45.
Yeah. On the way to the British Pacific Fleet, which we were sent out to join the BPF. We get out to Alex, and that's a very strange place. Interesting, but dangerous. The sailors, when they went ashore, were warned that there were certain out-of-bounds areas. And if the patrol went in there and caught a chap in one of the out-of-bounds brothel areas, be brought back on board, and you could be perfectly certain that he'd have caught a dose and he'd be had to send off the ship. That was, you weren't worried about whether they get a dose or not, but you didn't want to lose your ratings. And while we're in Alex, a torpedo air vessel exploded. A torpedo is driven by compressed air. Not everybody realizes just how compressed that air can be. And this torpedo, the torpedo tubes were underneath the, on the port side, underneath the twin anti-aircraft 4-inch mountings. And it wasn't an enclosed deck. Nevertheless, that air exploding pushed up the deck above it and broke, split it. The torpedo shot backwards through one of the barbettes, and a very surprised chief shipwright, who shouldn't have been there, but he was living, kipping in it, woke up, put his hand out, and there was a torpedo. The Royal Marine, sleeping above it in his hammock, was killed. That was the only casualty. But we had 2 months in Alex while it was all being repaired, which gave me the chance to go and see the pyramids and Cairo and spend time on Lake Timsa and the rest camp there. Didn't deserve it, but they didn't know what to do with us. Then we finally go out through the Suez Canal, past all the bitter lakes and out at the far end. And we go without stopping until we get to Colombo. And who should we see in Colombo but a sister ship, HMS Ceylon? And we asked, said, well, we had a marvellous time in Newfoundland. How's it going in Ceylon? And they said, bloody awful, mate. I don't see it the same way. And we went from there to the Cocos Islands to do something useful. I can't remember what it was. The Cocos or Keeling Islands, which was a telegraph station, which hadn't been attacked by the Japanese. It was totally remote. And that was quite interesting. Then we get to Fremantle, and on the jetty at Fremantle there was a trainload of fruit and veg from the Western Australia government waiting for us as a present. And we spent one day in Fremantle and went all round to Sydney. And we worked up from Sydney to do one or two bombardments on the New Guinea coastline, I remember.
What do you remember of that?
Truck. Where you'd be bombarded. I remember truck particularly because close up for action stations, bombarding shore positions. And there was the Royal Marine Major up in the director control tower. And all the guns, 6-inch guns, were all trained and firing away. And the target was on the starboard bow. And I happened to notice, because you don't notice these things as you look, I happened to notice that all the guns were actually aimed to port. And I said, excuse me, sir, gun, sir. He said, I'm busy. I said, yes, sir, but look at the... So he did, and we then continued the bombardment with using our 4-inch batteries. The director control goes down to a table which had broken down. There was the lack of... So that was a bit of an abortive do.
And what was your action stations on this ship? You haven't actually...
Well, I was officer of the watch, action stations. And his chief job was to keep the log going. The log is the diary. So everything that happens, every alteration, of course, the time, everything that happens on the bridge, opening fire, cease fire, everything, you're keeping... The log. And you hand the sandwiches round. Which was fairly time consuming. But it meant that you were there when it's all happening, but you were just the everybody's servant, you know. You, in fact, did con the ship. You were, if the captain said steer 310, you made sure you were steering 310. You did all that. But your responsibilities are no more than to make sure that any orders that he gave were carried out. So, after truck, we did another trip down to Sydney for some reason. And I think stores and re-ammunitioning and such like. It was a long way to go, but that was the way it was. There were no forward stations where we could ammunition and fuel. And then we went up, leaving Sydney at enormous speed, with all the stores still stuck on the quarter deck, still stowing away when we were leaving harbour. And we went straight up to Leyte, the Gulf of Leyte, in the Philippines, where we swung around an anchor for a couple of days, entertaining all the Americans who came on board, because they were dry and we weren't. So we had a queue of boats with very senior officers indeed coming in for a drink.
Well, how did you get on with them? How did you find them?
Well, I know at that level, all we did was salute them when they came on board, and that was it. They are funny people, the Americans. I believe they even wear moustaches, some of them. It's very odd. But by that time, of course, I was sporting a naval beard, a rather sort of splendid one. I modelled myself on the player's cigarette packet. I grew it on the way out. We came out over the from Aden to Colombo. I had plenty of time to grow. But you go to cruising stations. Cruising stations in a cruiser means you're going slowly to conserve fuel. You don't go that fast. So when we went up from Sydney to the Philippines, we were not at cruising stations. We were going very much faster. And when we got there, in the end, then the whistle blew. And we went straight off to Hong Kong. That was to get there before the Americans did, because the biggest problem that the Brits had was that in Hong Kong, there was no army anywhere near to reoccupy it. Near to in Burma, they were busy. And what we didn't want were the Americans to get into Hong Kong and claim it. I would never get them out again. So we went out with a small task force. Cruiser, aircraft carrier, couple of destroyers, and a depot ship. And we had an admiral. And when we get up to Hong Kong, all at action stations, cruising without any problem at all. We didn't know what to find. We knew all the Japs were ashore. So we dropped anchor, and somebody went ashore to check our. And then the next day, we were landed in various groups. I was landed with 30 sailors and stokers and people, and finished up at Stanley Bay, responsible for winkling out any Japanese are left behind and responsible for the security of it. And the security of that meant secured from the Chinese pirates, so-called the Chinese freebooters who would, in the interregnum, if you like, would loot. Now, Stanley Bay had the prison, and it had the barracks, which was a 13-inch batteries up there. And the prison housed the civilian internment camp. It was quite interesting. We only made contact with base once a day when the torpedo officer came around with the rum ration for the troops. I laid on telephone lines up to the fortress. I had my headquarters in the prison governor's house, and I ran the white ensign up, and it was all sort of a little bit showing the flag and making sure that the Chinese knew that we were in control. I remember one particular occasion when going up to the fortress, not knowing where to find up there, and there was a Chinese junk sailing towards us, and looking down on it, and I had these chaps with rifles, and I had my 4-5 revolver, which I was very anxious to use. I didn't know what on, but it was, you know, I never had one before, and I did want to fire it. And there was this junk. Now, I've been much more used to 6-inch guns. At one time in my career, I'd been officer in charge of the turrets, and I knew all about 6-inch turrets and 6-inch guns.